You're listening to Mischief Media.
Hey everyone, welcome to Extraneous as Dark Materials. I'm Melissa.
I'm Will.
And we are here for another week where we talk about the Amber Spyglass.
That's right.
We are getting through, we're almost halfway through the book.
Oh man. Yeah. And this week is like big themes, big ideas, big decisions. Every chapter is a big deal from here on in.
Here we go. Wrapping up a trilogy. So we're going to get right into it. But first, make sure that if you enjoy this podcast, you check out everything else on Mischief Media by just typing Mischief Media into your podcast player of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget to go to mischiefmerch.com and check out all the cool stuff we have there. Shall we do it? So the intro, I did the summary last time.
Oh, is it me?
It's you.
Oh, boy. I am ready.
Go.
So Will and Lyra are in a different world, and they go to sleep, and they wake up, and they have some chats, and then they go back into the previous world, and they see a lot of destruction, and they find Yorick, and it's a long walk, and they remake the knife, and then they decide to go to the land of the dead, and Yorick exits stage left, and that is it. And the Gallivespians come too.
Amazing. That's pretty much it for big chapters.
There's that a lot of like big conversations in there.
Big conversations. You know. And they sort of like end the stalemate with the Gallivespians.
Yes, right. Yeah. They become allies
in a sense. So the knife gets fixed. They decide to go to the world of the dead. The Gallivespians realize they're outmatched and go with them. The end.
Yeah, and we get kind of the Yorick send off.
Yeah, even though it's not really.
It's not really, but yeah, this is...
But it's him and Lyra saying what they think is goodbye. We're going to start with our epigraphs, as always.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 14.
Yeah, so chapter 14 starts with a John Ruskin.
Did you know John Ruskin?
Yes, he is a Victorian era art critic.
How do you know? I'm sorry. Hang on. Who among us? And listeners, please raise your hand if you too had heard of the Victorian era art critic, John Ruskin.
He, you know, I bet a lot of people who did English literature 201 or whatever in their college survey.
I'm not saying that when I was in college as an English major, I didn't come across or read something by John Ruskin. But with, you know, you talking about words per minute per page, add the times by the number of years it's been. And that name rings zero bells.
I haven't read a lot of him. I've read a few essays here and there. He was like a Victorian art critic. He had a lot of Victorian opinions about art. Like, I don't remember a lot of them, but he had a lot of ideas about, I think, art should have a balance. And like the Renaissance was like the height of a sort of balanced perspective in art, which reflected like a balanced perspective in the world. And he was a pretty good prose writer.
The epitome. Epitomically of what that what everything you just said about balance.
Right. It's like a very Protestant ethic-y kind of quote.
And the quote is?
It is, labor without joy is base. Labor without sorrow is base. Sorrow without labor is base. Joy without labor is base.
I completely object.
I bet you do. Yeah. So basically you're supposed to like work and be happy and sad, but always work.
You're not supposed to work without joy.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to work without sadness.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to be sad without work. And you're not supposed to be happy without work. You're right about the Protestant ethic.
It's very Protestant ethic, right?
Everything, the common denominator is work.
It's like work and struggle and experience sorrow, but take joy in that process.
But always be working.
Always be working.
What do you think it has to do with this chapter?
I think it has something to do with Yorick in a lot of ways.
Mm.
And it's weird because this is chapter 14, right? So the actual remaking of the knife is chapter 15. So I interpret this as being very much like Yorick's philosophy, if Yorick had a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Yorick, he's practical. He works metal, he hunts food, he protects his bears. He talks about it in chapter 15, especially of like, I am a bear. Like, I don't have doubts. I don't have, you know, my life is a very utilitarian life. I know what to do. And it's, you know, in a sense, very Protestant ethic-y here. I labor, I take joy in my labors. You know, I overcome struggles and I fight and I make war. and I lose people, and you know, I keep moving, and I don't really think too much about deviating from that process. Yeah.
It's also his very like, I am here and then I die and my body stays with the earth. That's it.
Yeah.
So my function is to work upon this earth, and that's that. And then the second epigraph is another William Blake, his fave.
His fave.
As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius. Now, this is the chapter where they fix the knife.
Yeah. And if you look up the rest of that quote, it is...
It says, which to angels look like torment and insanity?
Yes.
Was that, did I get it right?
Yes, you did.
Hey, nailed check it. Me out. Which to angels look like torment and insanity? And your reading of this.
Yeah, my reading of this, not having done like the big William Blake dive that one can certainly do, is so genius in this sense is like his conception of God, which is like a poetic genius, which is like a creative artist type. Very similar, we were saying, to Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost, you know, the supposed rebel who actually is the one who creates everything and questions everything and encourages free thinking, all of this. And so William Blake, in what I believe this is from one of his big vision poems where he like has this, these dreams or visions, and so he's...
Dante-like. Did ayahuasca and he
yeah, no,
wrote it all down.
It's very in that vein.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he's walking through and he's seeing the fires of hell and the enjoyments of genius, which are probably like art and creativity and music and poetry and free love and free thinking and sex and all this stuff that, you know, the angels, the, you could think of it here as the authority, would find to be torment and insanity.
Because I think that's why the rest of that quote is not in there, because it's very confusing to mention the angels the way he is talking about, because obviously we have a faction of angels that is very much on the side of quote-unquote genius and mm-hmm. creation and custom and all these things. And whereas he's pointing out again that the authority thinks this free will BS has gone on too long, that it's not really it's not what he wants if it doesn't mean full obeisance.
Right, exactly.
To him. And so all the things that come from it would, you know, to have that world where everybody's subject to the authority would be giving up poems and sex and all these things, the enjoyments of genius. And then he says they're all in, all these things are in hell. All these things are classified right. as in hell. which again points out a very distressful characterization of evil.
Yes, I agree. And also, obviously, he loves either a double meaning or a directly literal meaning.
Right.
You know, the literal fires of hell and the creation and the genius of Yorick. And also the, like, Yorick is having to step out of his comfort zone. Obviously, Yorick is not aligned with the angels, but like we were just saying, he has a very rigid worldview that does not include philosophy and free thinking and doubt.
And technology. I mean, just his armor.
And they have, like, the fire... hurlers, and they have...
Oh, I guess not, then.
They do have some weapons.
Yeah, but his whole, like, imbuing this item with, like, the worlds in which he is dabbling in this particular chapter leave him feeling wrong.
Wrong, right. Yeah.
So, well, let's get into what happens, how our characters progress in this. Start with Lyra.
Yeah.
As the chapters start with Lyra.
Let's do it.
Immediately we see Lyra, she's woken from this dream state, and she is so afraid of letting Will down that she won't even complain out loud about her very raw, blistery, weak feet as they're traveling across. Mm-hmm. And there's this lovely moment where Will goes off to relieve himself, and that's the first time she utters a complaint. And Lady Salmakia actually had waited for that moment to say to her, you know, like, it's no shame to be weak, but she recognized already that she didn't want to say anything in front of Will, or she didn't want to shame her in front of Will. They're such proud creatures, and that's such like a little grace note.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of respect, I think, even as there's like a lot of resentment and anger, and they're definitely... throughout the whole chapter, even once they announce their allies, not necessarily on the same side, there's always a respect.
Yeah. Another big piece from Lyra in these chapters, is additional complicated feelings about her mother. She feels like her mother was caring for her. She feels like she was telling the truth. She feels like she felt the care, you know, coming from her. And that's the first time she's ever felt that, because she realizes that she didn't have that at all growing up.
From anybody. It's interesting that Will lets her keep that memory.
Will knows Because what she says is, I think she was afraid I would die, and that's why she was doing it. And Will knows that's not true. She was doing it to bring her to Asriel, because that was her calculation. It might have been that she was still being honest about her care, but that she didn't think Lyra was going to die. She was causing her to be in the thing. So Will just, like, you know, let it be, recognizing that maybe it's okay for her to have those feelings.
Yeah.
Another bullet point about Lyra in these chapters. She has this great conversation with Yorick that points out how she's grown and how she's grown into her own set of beliefs, especially since she and Yorick met. Mm-hmm. So they're talking about going to the land of the dead, and she says, if we can do it, we have to. And Yorick says, can is not the same as must. And she says, but if you must and you can, there's no excuse.
Yeah, this is going back to a morality that she has expressed before. I'm thinking of her with Pan right after Rogers died at the end of the first book. I think we've talked about this scene where they realize, like, we have to do it. No one else is going to go investigate dust and go and, like, see what Asriel is trying to do. And they don't want to. And they're really scared. And, you know, because she's just with Pan, she can be honest about how she's feeling. But they understand that they have to do it. As soon as it's been said out loud, they have to do it. And Bullvanger, too. As soon as it's been said out loud, they have to do it.
Yeah.
And I think it's related to Lee Scoresby's, you know, you have to do the right thing in front of you.
The right thing in front of you, yeah. And every time she hasn't, something really bad has happened. When she's given into temptation, when she's not been truthful in her vows to Will, it keeps rebounding on her that she has to stick to, you know, knowing nothing else. She knows that she has to do what she can. That is an imperative. It's a moral imperative. She believes in moral imperatives.
You know what this conversation reminded me of, and the later conversation that she has with Will about the Land of the Dead? It reminded me of the scene in, I think, Return of the King, but it might have been Two Towers, where Sam is assessing, like, how much food they have. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I think we might have enough for the trip back. And Frodo's like, there's not going to be a trip back.
Yeah.
It's like, I think Lyra is understanding that her and Will's personal safety is secondary to their duty to the world.
And I don't even think she's factoring personal safety at all. She's like, this is my duty. I have to do it. Whatever comes.
Yeah.
And that's a big hero thing. That's a, I mean,
right.
Harry.
Big damn heroes.
Harry, Frodo, I mean, you're putting your finger on it. The big damn heroes have this moral imperative. Most of them anyway. Mm-hmm. If you must and you can, that's it.
Then there's no excuse.
Sometimes even if you don't know that you can.
Yeah.
And Yorick also says, again, repeating this Protestant work ethic that he has, while you're alive, your business is with life.
Yes. This is 100% a Protestant ethic. I mean, this could have been written by, you know, John Wesley or any of these, like, religious figures in the history of Protestantism.
And Yorick's a father figure to her, and she's gently disagreeing with him and just saying, no, I'm feeling confident enough in her own beliefs now, saying, no, I think you're wrong. And she says, our business is to keep promises, no matter how difficult they are. I don't know what belief system that falls into. Our business is to keep promises.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Lyra's code. And Lyra would not be interested in this conversation we're having at all, really. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She'd be like, I just have to do the thing I have to do. And death is no excuse.
Man, if we adapted our whole life to our business is to keep promises. Oh, it's a moral calling to take that garbage out. I promised I'd do it. I can and I must walk the dog. I can and I must pay the bills. No matter how difficult they are.
Right.
So Lyra's showing a lot of change and a lot of growth in these chapters.
Yeah, she really is. She's not playing. She's not interested in seeing the world. That sense of excitement she had when she set off with Egyptians towards the north. Remember that? When they got there and they got on the skis, and that she didn't see that the monkey was, like, chasing behind, and, you know, death and danger were stalking her, but she was just excited. She was a kid and she was excited. But I think that's gone.
Now we have Yorick. His big thing in these chapters is that he fixes a knife. But he also has a lot of really big grounding conversations with Will, with Lyra. And he sort of centers them and recenters their mission and their focus and makes them defend what their next actions are going to be. Mm-hmm. For instance, he won't fix the knife until Lyra reads the alethiometer, asks if the knife should be fixed, and knowing that she'll be honest with him, or at least as honest as Lyra ever is, makes them stop and think about everything they're doing.
Yeah.
And he hates the knife.
Yeah, he really hates it. He sees it as too dangerous, something that like disrupts the balance of the world. You know, he says the harm it can do is unlimited. It would have been infinitely better if it had never been made.
And we've talked about the knife a little bit like it, like a nuclear
yes
capacity, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a, like a targeted nuclear bomb. It's ripping holes in worlds. Not nuclear like Big Bang nuclear, but a weapon that is too powerful. A society reaches a point where they make the method of their own destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we know it as like nuclear capability, but this, it's just a knife, but it's a knife that
right.
can... in the wrong hands could be absolutely devastating.
Yorick represents an old world in a lot of ways too. He is a craftsman. He works with his hands. He works with natural materials. And there's a tension here because the good guys, quote unquote, in his Dark Materials are people who support scientific research. They support exploration of ideas. They support investigating the world. But when you do that, you uncover abilities like nuclear power, like weaponry, like the same technology that gets us to the moon is the reason that we can like hit Afghanistan with, you know, ICBMs from here. And the flip side, if you say, no, this is too dangerous, we can't investigate this, then you're saying we need to curtail scientific exploration
right.
to a certain level. And there's good and there's bad elements to that. And I think Yorick gets to this a little bit when he talks about the knife has intentions too.
Yeah.
A world where Yorick was making all the decisions would be a world that it wouldn't be the authority, but it might, in terms of like scientific research, play out in a similar way. Because like if you're going forward, you're going to uncover good and bad in yeah. the search for knowledge. And it's just a real problem. There's no solution to it except to not go forward. But humans, they don't do that even
no,
when they're not supposed to.
They do
keep doing it.
They yeah. do not. Another big thing about Yorick in these chapters is that we get finally, it's been hinted at, it's talked about a lot how delicate and amazing his big giant paws are and what a metalsmith he is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this is like a smash cut of, you know, this is like Rocky climbing the steps.
Uh-huh.
This is like one of those training montages where you see, you know, the Witcher at the top uh-huh. at the top of his form, just like slaying, crashing through the wood. This is when you see somebody doing what they were put on this earth to do at the absolute pinnacle
yeah.
of their abilities. It takes a little fire in a hut. They gather materials and he makes a forge that quiets the Galavespians who have seen Asriel's giant world-ending forges, and it gains their respect when they see what he can do. Like, this is the true master.
Yes. Will is expecting, you know, the most high-tech weapons and the latest forges and the best tools available. And it's like, oh, and he came to realize that these were the best tools available and this was the greatest forge conceivable.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when you see second and third rate craftspeople impressing with giant rigs and technology uh-huh. and everything else. And
yeah.
then you walk into the master craftsman's, you know, room and they have a table and a hammer. And it's like, give that to me.
Dom Toretto pulling out the old muscle car at the beginning, at the end of the last Fast and Furious.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
You know, none of these supercars. I'm going to the 1960
it's so
Mustang.
It's exactly what it is. How is Yorick Bernison like Dom from Fast and Furious? There's a lot of Yorick in these chapters. He has a lot of doubt about fixing the knife. And I guess we'll talk about that more when we talk a little bit more in depth about that process.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has individual chats with Will and Lyra. And here's, you know, their plans. And does something remarkable, which is basically say, like, you know better and you know your own path best. And if there was anybody who I would trust Lyra to walk through this world with, it's Will. So he basically, like, as a dad, sort
yeah,
of says
the blessing.
The blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he says, I am not happy that you should do what you plan, but there's no one I would trust to go with you except that boy. You are worthy of each other, which is knowing the esteem he holds for Lyra.
Mm-hmm.
What a statement.
Yeah, I mean, that's the greatest comment you can give Lyra.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my dear friend.
My dear friend. All right, Will. How does Will change and grow in this chapter?
Oh, man. What a Will chapter this is. It's like, this is an actual therapy session for Will. You know, he like gets really into all the depths of everything he's feeling. He find out why the knife broke. I've forgotten when we were talking earlier about why that we thought the knife had broken. I forgot completely that it gets explained.
That he was divided. Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. He was divided. And Yorick says to him, like, you have to put away childish things now. Mm-hmm. You have to step up. You are the bearer of the knife, and that comes with responsibilities. And one of those is not thinking about your mother when you have a role to save. Like, suck it up, Buck, is basically what he was, in a kind of more direct Yorick way. But we also find out what he's most afraid of, which is never getting back to his mother.
Yeah, you know, we hear that he does have some really tender memories of his mother. And, you know, his mom doesn't know where he is. And for all she knows, his father abandoned them. And so he's really terrified that his mother is going to have to be subjected to this too. And then to go through the world thinking that nobody loves her. You know, the two people who are supposed to both abandoned her.
Quick note about the Galavespians, their unending obsession with honor and chivalry and doing what's right, kind of like, snares them. They're in it's sort of what we see in the world right now, right? The people who have no shame just go on doing what they're doing, and the people with shame, you know, the second they betray their code, we lose them. They go off to to obscurity. The Salmakian and Tialis are very concerned with doing right, and so Will manages to sort of catch them on that, on those technicalities, and gets them on his side.
Yeah, they are wary. Tenuous allies here. They're so angry, and Will is so angry, but they recognize, first of all, that Yorick is not someone you want to mess with, having those little spurs or not.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
That's never going to work on Yorick.
It would be tough. I think it would be it would be interesting to see what would happen if Yorick got stung by one of those.
I mean, it would kill a human, probably slow a bear.
It would probably slow a bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. They switch tactics very well. Like, you can tell that they have been in a lot of tight spots. You know, the Lady Salmakia kind of comes in and immediately assesses the situation. It's like, hey, we're sorry. I apologize for, like, you know, we should have honored you. It's an honor to be in your presence. Like, she understands how these things work, and they're very perceptive to, like, trying different strategies while still trying to maintain their own mission. I don't know. They're really good operators.
Yeah. Everything that Will and Lyra think they're pulling off on them, they know. Mm-hmm. They have this conversation where it's like, okay, so obviously they're planning to cut through another world, and we have to keep on him. And this one is likely to lie, and this one's not likely to lie. They say about Lyra, she's innocent, she loves easily, which
they're like, we can use that.
We can use it. But I thought that was such a on the nose statement.
Yeah.
For a Lyra, she does love easily.
She does.
Lyra.
It's true.
The last character we've got down here for these chapters is the alethiometer comes back as a chapter.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Lyra consults it to ask if the knife should be fixed. And she says, I've never known it so confused. There's lots of things it said. I think I got it clear. It said about balance, that the knife could be harmful or it could do good. And then after she says all that, she also says to Will later, when she's not being watched by the Galavespians, that it says that the knife would be the death of dust, but that it's also the only way to keep dust alive. And she doesn't. She does just like, so the alethiometer, it almost seems like it's getting to the heart of the matter. It's like, it was a very important question to ask the alethiometer, where the alethiometer doesn't really have an answer for you. That it all depends on your will. God, could Will have been called anything else but Will?
No, he couldn't have.
Yeah, it all depends on the person holding it, which is true of consciousness and creation and everything.
Yeah, it just shows it's all about the bearer. It's all about the decisions they make. It emphasizes that it all comes down to them. It's all about Lyra. It's all about Will. The alethiometer can't help them. They are going to have to nail this themselves. And it is far from a sure thing that they can do so.
Yeah.
That like destiny, just because there is destiny swirling around Lyra does not mean that she is going to land, you know, on the right side of it.
Yeah. It also, it just keeps pointing out how power is nothing next to the people who wield it, or the forces that wield it. The forces that wield it are the thing, and power is neutral.
Hey gang, you've probably already heard of Loot Crate, the original fan-powered subscription service that sends you crates full of cool, geeky stuff every single month.
Yeah, you can choose a general theme of stuff like anime or sci-fi and get a range of products that way, or you can go more specific, like Marvel themed only.
Yeah, this is a company that is run by fans like us, like you. So they're working hard to get fellow fans products that they will love.
And they offer local shipping in a ton of different countries, because usually we have to do some sort of disclaimer like only available in the US or Canada. Not with Loot Crate.
So go ahead and click the link in the description and use the code STAYEXTRA, that's STAY EXTRA, one word thing, for 15% off your first order. That's code STAYEXTRA for 15% off at lootcrate.com.
That's also one word thing, lootcrate.com.
Mm-hmm, it's one word thing.
Just click the link in the description to get started. Dust Bears. All right, let's just talk about the process of this whole process of building the knife.
Oh my gosh.
First of all, what had to happen?
They had to build up the furnace. They had to put rocks around it that would give off certain gases that would keep the oxygen away to prevent the metal from oxidizing and becoming weak, because any contact with the actual world would like weaken the knife. I guess it's a metal. That's an actual like metalworking thing.
Philip Pullman with many, many books on metalworking before doing this.
He must have brushed up. This is like pre-Wikipedia too.
Totally.
Yeah. And then they just concentrate the fire. They concentrate the heat. And then I guess they had to piece each piece together. And
then Will was the final ingredient.
Yeah.
He had to keep the pieces together in his mind. And then as each one got joined, he had to remember their exact contours and sort of work with the matter, the electrons, the whatever, the dust holding it together, that the magic of this knife is about. You know, he yells at him, York yells at him and says, hold it still in your mind. You have to forge it too. This is your task as much as it is mine, which is probably something that's true about sky armor. And probably that's like a notion that he knows that that you build it. You build something for yourself that is made for a person, and that person has to be part of the process. So this is something that Yorick is up to, but they all, even Pan has a role. Lyra's fanning the flames. Pan's there's a crow or something, just like like fanning it, and it works. I mean, it works. They put this world ending, the eye shatter. They put it back together. It's dust. It's wounded. It's a little
smaller.
It's a little smaller. It's a little charred.
Yeah,
but it works. They put together an infinitesimal point that could rip a snag in the fabric of the universe with the power of their minds.
Yeah, the power of their minds and of Yorick's precise craftsmanship.
And it fills Yorick with doubt.
Yes, right. It's his potentially greatest accomplishment and the one thing he's done in his life that he does not feel good about. I thought that was so interesting. It's like, this is the first thing in my entire life done that I wasn't sure about.
He says, I'm troubled. I have never been troubled before. Now I'm full of doubt. Doubt is a human thing, not a bear thing. And if I'm becoming human, something's wrong. Something's bad and I've made it worse. And he's thinking about you for Arachnison. Mm-hmm. But Will so smartly says to him, but when the first bear made the first piece of armor, wasn't that bad too in the same way? And Yorick's kind of like, yeah, I guess so. And he says this, that making that armor was when custom began. And that made me think that that is the common denominator. All these things we've been looking for, consciousness, where art started getting more complicated, that 33,000 years ago moment, it might be the beginning of custom, the beginning of actions and creations that connect other humans, custom.
Yeah. Intentions beyond survival.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that is really, I think that's probably right. And it's a really important piece of how this world is conceived, because that is when dust started entering the world, right?
Right.
And started getting a foothold with conscious beings.
I mean, this is the difference between, like we were talking about last week with sentience, the Mulefa versus the grazers.
Yeah.
This is the humans versus animals in this world. It's custom that happens between them, and dust.
Yeah.
Is what encourages custom. And the angels started making all that happen 33,000 years ago. Another big dust bear, the implications of what they are about to do, right? This is the preamble. Now they forged their own tool to go into the world of the dead. Mm-hmm. And Lyra asks the alethiometer about this journey. And Will says to her, did it say what would happen if we didn't go? And she said, just emptiness, just blankness. I think that means the lithiometer was telling her, if you don't go into the world of the dead.
Now that we understand what the world of the dead is, you know, the whole world will be like that. This is the big battle. And if they don't go, they'll lose the battle and the authority will win. And we've already heard about Metatron's plans for all of the worlds to basically become like the world of the dead.
Who wants that?
I know.
What kind of world do you want to rule over? One where all that exists are work camps? I don't understand this.
Sounds boring. I mean, horrible, but also just boring.
Horrible and boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Our dust bunnies. One of them is that they play the lodestone and they really describe it.
Yeah.
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 It's like an alethiometer or a violin. Yeah.
Yeah. This was fascinating. It was like, I don't understand quantum entanglement. But I know that it is a concept out there, and it's fascinating that it's like, I don't know how it works, but it's fascinating that we get this description, and it's something that you really can drill down into, and that there is so much thought to it, and it really has to do with manipulating atoms and like the very fabric of the universe in a way that reminds me of the knife.
It just seems like everybody keeps figuring out ways to have an alethiometer, right?
Yeah.
And it's just the common denominator is the dust that is trying to spill secrets of the universe into the world, and certain people and creatures and whatever you want to call them have figured out how to read it. Will takes the knife and he feels whole again with it in his hand, and he remarks that he couldn't believe how much he loved it. He forgot that he loved it, that he's like, he's like, oh, no, I am the bearer. This is another big moment for him.
He had to fully become the bearer before he was ready to do what he needs to do next. So, yeah, I feel like he leaves his mother behind, which is really tough and really sad and obviously a preview of something else. But he really has to focus his entire intention on the knife and by extension on the task in front of them.
And then one more bunny, just this kind of throwaway way that Yorick says, he died bravely, I shall avenge him, about Lee Scoresby.
Yeah.
I don't even know if that's true, but...
I don't even remember, but it's a noble thing. And it's a noble thing. Yorick hasn't... It's like the North remembers, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Yorick hasn't forgotten.
All right, alethiometer readings.
All right.
My three.
Uh-huh.
One is the sun for authority, truth, and all the things that the alethiometer is trying to tell them and trying to show them about the world. And also Will and Lyra kind of standing in their truth and saying, no, we don't have a choice. We know. They get to truth.
Yeah.
The other one is the crucible because obviously.
Yeah.
Because they made a crucible. But it's not just on the surface like that. They really did create a furnace to forge their own way through the world, which is very cool. And my third is the bull for Yorick.
Oh, cool.
Because of his deep honesty, his inability to lie to Lyra, his inability to let something go, his ability to sense when Will is lying to him and cuff him on the shoulder and throw him onto the ground.
Very, very progressive therapy technique.
Right, very, just hits him.
punch the 14-year-old so he talks about his feelings.
Oh, boy. Only mythical fairy tale bears can do that. But yes, so those are my three.
Awesome. My first one is the tree for Yorick Bernison, for obvious reasons, you know, standing firm in his deep roots and his lack of doubt and his strength of conviction, which is tested by the hurricane of events, to extend the metaphor. The apple for the forbidden sort of internal knowledge that all the characters, but especially Will, have to confront and deal with, you know, its real inner self and inner knowledge of self that they have to fully inhabit before they're ready for this terrible next step that lies in front of them. And then I picked the globe because it is the thing that they are going beyond. They're going actually off the map.
Off the map. We're onto a wholly different, yeah.
So this is, you know, they've always been on the globe. This is the first time that we're conscious of the existence of the globe because we are going to transcend it.
All right, extra award time.
Extra award. Mine is the Chevalier Tialis.
Oh, really? Why him? Why him specifically?
Because he's just so...
He's just extra?
He's so extra. He's like, you are not the story here. He's like trying to argue with Will, and he's like yelling at Lyra, and he's demanding that they come with him. And he's like, but the gyrochopters will be here any minute, young man.
Right. But surely you're coming with us to Asriel. And he's like, no,
I'm like, really no, not. They're like, obviously not. Like,
what did you think was going to happen here? Yeah. I mean, I don't think we can get out of this chapter without giving it to Yurik.
Oh, yeah.
Come on. He made a great pizza oven in the middle of this land, and he turned it into a forge for the god-killing weapon to send off into the world without him. And then yes. he does the fade into the snow exit, the long goodbye, the deep talks, the grand farewell. What a Yurik chapter.
Right.
You know?
He literally walks off into the sunset.
And just like basically. Fades because yeah. he's such
he fades into the
he
snow.
He just fades into the snow.
Yeah. And there's that line before he talks to Will where he like shakes himself into the snow. And it's something about like as though he had always been of this, like he'd always yes. been made of snow.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the past in a sense going away. It's the old world.
Well, gang, that's the end this week. No mixtape this week. We will get back to it, but I think you'd prefer an episode to a mixtape.
I think so.
Our lives are a little wild right now.
They are, but we encourage you to check out Mischief Media. Check out our Patreon, patreon.com/makingmischief, if you like more of this.
Remember, head to Loot Crate using the link in our show notes and use the code STAYEXTRA, all one word thing, at checkout for 15% off your first order.
And hey, we are, and you should,
stay extra. We are Stay Extra, everybody. Bye!
Bye.
I like that, actually.